From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood.
Hollywood Hour.
I'm leaving.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
The Residence Inn.
Yes, all the way from the Residence Inn. It's
in TV, Pontiac.
TV's Dean Haglund.
Hi, everyone. How are
you? So I'm glad that we've established the hotel, the city, but nobody knows the state, so that's fine. They can't track you down.
No, there's plenty of room as a Residence Inn. You are more than welcome.
The show is brought to you by the now guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. They stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn, but hosts of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at Pontiac's luxurious Residence Inn. Tell me about the exciting Wi-Fi.
The exciting Wi-Fi. Wow, there's two. I didn't realize there's two levels of Wi-Fi. There's the average Wi-Fi, and then for Platinum and Elite members of the Residence Inn, they get the ultra-fast Wi-Fi, which I didn't sign. I didn't realize. I clicked the wrong button, and I clicked it for 15 days, and there's no way to retro to unclick to go to the ultra-fast. So I am stuck for at least 2 to 3 more days.
I feel like this is the result of the FCC repealing net neutrality.
Yeah, right? I had throttled down because I didn't realize coming back that net neutrality had passed and that there was indeed a two-tiered system now. We're in a two-tiered system of the internet. That is ridiculous, people.
Look at it this way, though, Dean. If our listeners were not people who themselves had throttled down, would they be listening to this podcast? I don't think so.
No, you'd be watching YouTube videos, right?
Well, or nonstop midterm coverage.
Oh, my gosh. That's the other thing. I can't watch TV. It is just... What is there sales of things? Are people buying things? Are we just voting and hating the other guy who we're not voting for and over again?
You have just been seeing America from afar for a few years, haven't you?
I forgot the political ads.
So
what a thing that is.
We will not be discussing midterms at all. When you listen
fantastic.
To, I mean, we're recording this on a Monday morning. It's like old times back here in the States. The big midterm is tomorrow. And as long as you vote, that's it. Just go vote. That's the end of our midterm message. Really?
I like it. Yeah.
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 Okay. Because we've got important things to talk about, haven't we? And we're going to get the ball started with Dean Haglund's trip to Windsor and a very special live event of the week.
The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
That's what I said, Garrett Watley. So, Dean Haglund, the first question, where is Windsor?
Well, surprisingly, I don't know if you could hear it in the background, but the Canadian geese are flying south for the winter. And that means they're leaving Detroit and heading into Windsor. It's the only part of Canada where you actually drive south from America to get into it. So if you imagine the Great Lakes, there is a little bit of peninsula of Ontario that actually tucks underneath Detroit on the Detroit River. So Detroit River runs east-west, and Detroit is north. Windsor is south across a bridge, or the way we did, a tunnel, which was built in the 1930s, and 75% of all the illegal alcohol that came in during Prohibition came through that tunnel right there.
Wow, that's now when you crossed over, I assume you went with Patty to see the show?
Indeed I did, yes.
When you crossed over to go into Canada, did you give her the same warning that you gave me when we crossed the border together, which is don't tell them we're making a movie. Don't tell them we're making a movie. Don't.
Yes, I did, actually. I said, don't tell them were investors and executive producers of The Lady Killers.
Ah,
I said, keep that a,
yeah,
keep that a secret.
It's very controversial up there. It's very.
It sure is.
So you went into Windsor to see an evening of comedy and music and comedy.
And comedy and music. And yes, I saw Steve Martin and Marty Short in their two-man, very highly, shockingly highly entertaining show. And of course, if you are a Netflix member, you can watch that show on Netflix. It's Steve Martin and Marty Short on an evening you'll soon forget, I think is the title of it. And in fact, they did a lot of the same bits. There's a Stepbrother to Jesus that Marty sings, one of his unfortunate early Broadway shows that he did. They do banjo playing, the Steve Canyon Rangers, of course, that fiddle player.
No, the Steve Canyon Rangers are great. I've seen, of course, Steve Martin perform music with the Steep Canyon Rangers several times. Never grow tired of that. The music is so good. I mean, isn't that the difference? I mean, the show is longer in person than it is on that Netflix special.
That's correct. It was a 2-hour show.
Yeah, and I think it's 75 minutes on Netflix. And I think one of the things they cut out is a lot of the music.
Yeah, because there is a point where Steve does 2 or 3 songs with the band, and then he leaves, and the band just performs on their own to show off their skills independently, as it were. And man, that in itself, super entertaining.
Now I've seen the show, and I've seen the Netflix show, and I'm going to see the show again at the Greek Theater this coming year. In 2019. And my memory was, and I don't remember how well you remember the Netflix show, but my memory of it was that Martin Short was more inclined to change the material and mix things up than Steve Martin was.
Right. Yes. Well, I think they are both mixing it up because they were doing stuff. I don't remember Send in the Clowns, them ending with Send in the Clowns. Did you see that? They got a
No. I did not. So that's different.
Oh, okay. So they got a thing. It seems that Steve Martin's at the piano, Marty Short's sitting on top, and they're singing in Send in the Clowns, and then Steve would stop and go, "What idiot cannot summon clowns?" Basically, and going on a bigger and bigger rant that became, you know, comically hilarious. And it seemed that it was cracking up Marty Short because it seemed improvisational that, you know, he would stop and just go ballistic. Rarely have I seen Steve go that crazy except since his early days in stand-up. So there was like really neat parts where they were given the freedom to go off on bits, go off and do things, you know. And it the structure's there, but it also had, like my show is, right? You have the structure, but you can go off on improvisational tangents and not bore yourself silly by going and doing the same thing town after town, city after city.
Well, don't kid yourself. I mean, I think that this show, Martin Short and Steve Martin, really is a precursor. It points the way for what Chill Pack Hollywood Hour on stage is going to be like 10 years from now.
Is that right? Oh, yes. We tell urbane witty stories of our early days showing family photos. That's always good.
In truth, I must say about Steve Martin that many of the jokes that he does are the same jokes that I heard him do when touring with the Steep Canyon Rangers, now going back almost 10 years.
Yeah. And I'm going to say that this is part of craft and something I was unaware of, that actually showing the material on Netflix, it heightens the entertainment of seeing it live somehow. That you go, hey, do that bit that I enjoyed so much on TV, and I'll laugh again at it, which is so weird. It used to be, as a stand-up, once you did your material on television, everybody's seen it, you have to write new material. But now it seems, do your material, have it up on YouTube, have it up on television, and then like doing popular hits in a band, comics are requested to do the bit that they saw on television, the reason they came there. You know, it's like Jim Jeffries doing his gun control bit of, you know, locking the gun in the safe. That whole bit, he is now requested to do time and time again, and he refuses to do it.
Yeah,
he refuses.
Right.
Yeah, it's like you've seen it. So it's this weird, weird thing that for the longest time, you know, comics would steal each other's material and do it on TV, and then you would go, oh, yeah, sorry, it's already, I did it first, so therefore I claim ownership, even though I know I stole that bit from you.
It is,
you know, it's
it is a weird thing in comedy when people are playing the hits, and but you know, people go to concerts and they do expect the hits, right? Musically,
right.
That's what you do.
Yeah.
I mean, Steve Martin himself has a great line when he and the Rangers play a new song, and he'll say, you know, we're going to play a new song, and if you're like me, when you hear that an artist is going to play a new song, you say, please don't.
yeah.
You know, go record it, push it, make it a hit, and then come back and play it. But there is an element that everything that's new or everything that's old is new again.
Is new again,
and
right?
This is the segue that could not be more perfect, because I want to discuss, again, the recent spate of rebooted television shows. And I want to do it for two reasons, honestly, and not even just because it's news. But when I say recent spate, obviously, the high watermark seems to be Will and Grace in terms of audience receptivity, in terms of the ratings. Roseanne, of course, was doing quite well. The reboot without her, not so well.
Right.
The low watermark seems to be Murphy Brown in terms of ratings. And you know, I'm sure there's others that we could talk about, but the, obviously the news that a new Captain Picard series is coming, and Frasier is coming back with the original cast. So
you're kidding?
I'm not kidding, and I'm not surprised either. So if we can look at just Murphy Brown and why that might, and let's just say that quality doesn't matter from these shows. And I'm not saying that. I haven't really been watching these, but obviously to the degree that we can pretend that quality doesn't matter in terms of the ratings, I think there's some obstacles for a Murphy Brown that did not stand in the way of a Will and Grace and a Roseanne, even though Murphy Brown had more viewers back in the 80s than Will and Grace did, because, of course, audience size was already starting to be fractured by the time of Will and Grace's first run. But Murphy Brown predates millennials, predates young people. The thing that's good about a Will and Grace, and even to a degree a Roseanne, is that all the adult generations know it. Because even if you were a kid, your older siblings watched it, for example.
Right.
Whereas Murphy Brown predates it. There are literally television audiences that had never heard of it. So that's one strike against it. And then the other thing is, in the divided political climate, planting Murphy Brown now into it, it's not that it's quote-unquote too liberal, though it might be. What it is that Murphy Brown, back then, looks a lot like news media now.
I know, right?
So if you wanted to watch Murphy Brown, just turn on any of the news channels.
You get that show.
And so I don't see its need in the place.
Need. This is where the conversation shifts.
I don't want to shift the conversation into the obvious themes that we always go to, which are true. Which is, one, we know why these shows are getting produced, and we're not even going to mention that dirty little secret. We're not going to mention sucking the bones of these corpses dry. We're not going to mention the snake eating its own tail, shitting it out, and eating that. I want to look at the positive of it, of what these shows could do, and why I'm all right with it. Let's take, for example, Frasier. What Kelsey Grammer said was he's interested in what that man's third act might be. We are a nation where the majority of our people are either in or approaching their third act. And the idea of exploring a third act, therefore, holds some real cultural meaning to it. And let's look, I was not a huge Frasier fan, but that character, yes, it actually is an interesting concept, especially if you were entertained by him. What would that third act be like? The first act and the second act was quite an evolution. So what would he be doing today? The same is true with Captain Picard. When no longer a captain in Starfleet, would that explorer, would that educator, would that man of letters not lead an interesting third act to his life?
That's very true, isn't it? I didn't realize that was the model they were going with the new Picard shift. I haven't been following the behind-the-scenes news on it.
No, because you just are scared of being bit by the snake that is so busy eating its own tail, understandably. But I'm trying to look at it at the positive of that. And then the so I think that could... Shows that do that could be inspiring, could be an interesting model for people. Could
right,
have something...
But Murphy Brown doesn't seem to be doing that. So Murphy Brown is trying to pick up exactly where it left off.
Exactly. And although Roseanne picked up seemingly where it left off, there is still relevance to that because, you know what? Blue-collar families that were struggling in the 90s, struggling now.
Right. And, exactly.
That is their third act. Their third act is not different than their second act. In fact, the big fear is, you're going to die before maybe your own children break out of this cycle. And,
Jesus.
And so there's relevancy to that exploration. I would also say politically, there is a wonderful potential for healing by exploring these beloved characters that came before the gigantic red state, blue state tribalism that swept over this country. There is an incredible opportunity in bringing these characters back on stage. As we know, Star Trek at its best explores political issues. Roseanne explored political issues. And... in fact, I once read, and this is the sad part to me, really, of Roseanne herself going nuts and quite rightly being canned from her show because of her personal behavior. This is the sad part of it. Here was a show that, as one op-ed piece said, I think in the New York Times, it's ironic that a right-leaning show could end up being a better source of, I don't know, not attack isn't the right word, but of questioning the president and holding the president accountable than all
right.
those people who are the resistance. Because this was a woman, Roseanne Barr, and a family, a fictional family that was living in Trump's America. They were in that rust belt that went Trump. And yet, they're the ones not feeling the trickle-down effect of his policies. And so you really got to explore that. You got to explore how are the policies affecting or not affecting people. And it was doing that in the show with Roseanne until, of course, she was no longer there. But in a larger sense, I think there is this opportunity where these beloved characters that were beloved by all of America can... can address the issues that are affecting America and might enable us all to look at them with a slightly different perspective. I mean, can you imagine Frasier, of course, blue state Frasier, right? He was an elite. He is the liberal elite, for crying out loud.
Right.
Not so much as his brother Niles was the liberal elite, but he still was the liberal elite. And can you imagine maybe how he has shifted and where he has gone in his third? Because people do tend to become more conservative as they get older. And so anyway, that's just what I wanted to place on the table. And
interesting. I would never thought you would be for these reboots. I thought this would be your very disaster, a la Alec Guinness, saying if we're still telling the same stories 30, 40 years from our culture has not progressed. And case in point, Star Wars, right? We're still telling that same story, the same Jungian myth that hasn't evolved at all. And so I guess that if we have reboots, the theory is the story is readapted.
Here's the difference, I would say. Alec Guinness had no problem with the same stories being told. I mean, obviously, he appeared on stage in classics. I loved the comment. I watched an interview with Quentin Tarantino from a few years ago, and he was talking about how his third act might be writing theater. And I was like, oh my God, wouldn't that be awesome? He could be a great playwright. And one of the things that really excited him was he loves characters. He loves writing characters. And he loves the idea that, unlike in movies where you write these characters and if you cast it really well, then that character becomes indelibly intertwined with the actor who played it. No one other than Samuel Jackson can play Jules in Pulp Fiction, right? No one. That's it.
Right.
That's who he is. But on stage, no matter how perfectly cast you are, you're only indelibly intertwined with that role, well, till the next production, if the next production's good. And, you know, it's like Eugene O'Neill does Iceman Cometh. It's a legendary play, wonderful performances, but he doesn't live long enough even to see Jason Robards do it. So the guy who's most indelibly linked in our imagination with playing that role, the playwright himself, did not live long enough to see because it was so many years after the play first premieres. But so the point is these plays, these works that get reinterpreted again and again and again are character-driven. Star Wars, perhaps you could argue that the first one is, but they stop being that. It is a machine that plugs new characters into the exact same apparatus again and again and again.
Interesting. Yeah, right. The product locomotive. So these TV shows are not product locomotives.
Well, they are. They are, of course, as we know, economically, because we need to get as big an audience as we can, even though we're not going to make money off this show because the costs will be too high, but they will be a product locomotive because they're going to get eyeballs on our network, on our on-demand, on our subscription service. And also we can advertise our other shows while they're watching it.
Right.
And that will increase the audience across the board, as hit shows always were. By the time they are the big, big hits, that's the thing, you know, that it's kind of counterintuitive about the television business. Historically, the biggest hits lose the most money because the costs are so high because you have to pay all the creative talent for having produced a hit. And there's no way to get that money back until it was in syndication.
Right.
But the networks would pay those carriage fees because those hits were driving eyeballs to their other products.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I'm going to watch them now.
I'm just saying that there is, you know, how is it right? Because we know why it's wrong. We know why, from an economic standpoint, from a business standpoint, why sucking the bones dry might not work. But from a cultural standpoint, why is it right? What might the opportunity be? And I think I've given you two positive possibilities.
Right. Okay.
All right.
Awesome.
Hey, to bring down the room, let's open up the Chill Pack morgue.
Okay.
Celebrity deaths.
First one's really rough for me, Dean Haglund. A man who is quite possibly the greatest trumpeter of his generation, Roy Hargrove, dies at 49 years of age. Same age as your friend in podcasting, Phil Lernes. 49. Legendary jazz trumpeter died of cardiac arrest stemming from a longtime fight with kidney disease. But again, the word gets thrown around so much, but an absolute genius who, in addition to jazz and working with such, you know, greats as Sonny Rollins and Herbie Hancock and Oscar Peterson, he also, you know, produced and recorded and played on so much hip hop and popular music with the likes of Erykah Badu and Common. He was a 2-time Grammy winner. He was first discovered by Wynton Marsalis when he was still in high school in Texas.
Wow.
After 1 year at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, he transferred to the New School in New York and soon started releasing solo albums and working with so many notable musicians and producers. He was known, this is a quote from his manager, he was known just as intensely for his brimming fire and fury as he was for his gorgeous signature balladry. Over and over, his sound attested to and sanctified his deep love for music. His unselfish timbre covered the waterfront of every musical landscape. That is his manager's words. Mine are that, quite simply, one of the greatest shows I ever saw was Roy Hargrove and his band at Yoshi's in Oakland with our friend Yoshi Kato. And it is a seminal experience for me. And it's too much of a bummer. It's too much of a bummer, and it reminds me of the 2016 election, quite frankly, where we lost so many great figures. And I'm worried that this is going to open the floodgates, quite frankly.
Oh, no.
We need Roy Hargrove more than ever, but the more that I read about the man, and I hate the idea that his life was so painful, but at the same time, he turned this pain and expressed it in his music, and his music lives on forever. And he does strike me as someone who did what he came here to do.
Wow. That's amazing. Can't we, oh, don't we wish we all had that as our epitaph?
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah.
Okay, you know, last week I mentioned a great World War II hero from the land of my people.
Yes, and the Norwegian.
And this week, another great World War II hero, and it strikes me that we are heading headlong into the season where we're going to get a lot of these obits. Because, I don't know, maybe this is just me, but I have observed, I have no math to back this up, but that as we approach the anniversary of the start of World War II, we tend to lose more of these figures.
Right.
And also, of course, people who served in World War II are in their late 90s at least now.
Right.
So there are going to be very few of these individuals left. But this week, Harry L. Ettinger died. He and his family escaped Nazi Germany in 1938 on one of the last visas granted by the German government.
Wow.
After graduation from high school in Newark, New Jersey, he joins the army and is sent back to his homeland to fight in the Battle of the Bulge, but was pulled out at the last minute to work as a translator since, of course, he spoke German.
Right.
And that led him to being assigned to the Monuments Men.
Oh, cool. That saved Nazi art from that giant cave.
I don't think it's Nazi art. I think they had purloined the art.
The Nazi stolen art.
Yeah.
It's not Nazi art. It was stolen by the Nazis when they plundered all the great art galleries around all their occupied countries.
Yes. It was a few hundred members of Allied soldiers, mostly made up of art historians and architects that were literally racing the clock to recover and save valuable artwork stolen by the Nazis. And if you've never seen Monuments Men, please don't.
I know.
Because as much as that description makes it, wow, they race the clock to do this, there's no sense of racing anything. Other
no.
than
yeah, I know.
Maybe we can get this scene done before we hit the bar, gents. because
wow.
it has all the urgency of a Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin Rat Pack movie.
oh my gosh, that's so true.
But as
sad.
We talked about, a great, great movie could have been made from it. But getting back to Ettinger, he was in fact an art aficionado. Now he was assigned because, again, as a translator, but he was, because he was an art aficionado, he was assigned to James Rorimar, one of the leaders of the team. And while below ground in salt mines in Germany, going through crates of stolen artwork, it is Ettinger who finds Rembrandt's famous self-portrait.
Wow.
The same painting he had tried to see repeatedly in his hometown in Germany, but since he was Jewish, he'd been prohibited from entering the museum.
Wow. Did not know that story.
Yeah. No.
That's amazing.
You wouldn't, because you'd seen the movie.
Well, yes, and I did, yeah.
Anyway,
that's exactly right.
That is
yeah.
that is an amazing, amazing story. So here's an interesting one. What is the claim to fame, Dean Haglund, for the woman Dorcas Riley? D-O-R-C-A-S Riley. Dorcas Riley. What's her claim to fame, Dean?
Oh, screenwriter.
My reaction to telling the claim to fame to Lily, her reaction rather, was after taking in Dorcas Riley's story, she said, "Her name is Dorcas?" so she created the iconic green bean casserole in 1955, Dean Haglund, while working as a staff member in the kitchen at the Campbell Soup Company. People forget this, but like a lot of these companies, right, they have these staff kitchens to create recipes to go along with these products so that you would buy them as staples for a wide variety of meals. And cream of mushroom soup was a popular base for casseroles around the country, but Riley was the first to add frozen green beans. Campbell Soup estimates that to this day, 40% of their sales of cream of mushroom soup goes towards making green bean casserole.
You're kidding me. That's shocking. That's a shocking statistic.
What you learn on this show. I mean, look at this. Look at the what we're talking about. People's third acts, rebooted television shows. We're talking about how comedy, live comedy performances, has changed. We're talking about the Monuments Men, jazz greats, and the history of green bean casseroles. What other show? I demand, Dean, for you to tell me what other show covers this wide range.
I got nothing has that. All right.
Tony Joe White was a swamp rock legend who wrote the classic songs Polk Salad Annie. I think classic maybe is being used liberally here. But also Rainy Night in Georgia. He grew up in Louisiana and began performing at school dances. He signed with Monument Records in 1967, first hitting the charts in 69 with Polk Salad Annie. His swamp rock music had elements of Cajun, country, blues, rock, and R&B. And, you know, I just kind of love that story because it was a reminder, and I don't know if this is still true, but do bands anymore cut their teeth by playing school dances? Because it was true even when I was a kid, like big bands. Huey Lewis in the News, where I grew up, was a popular, you know, high school prom band before they hit it big. Does that still happen?
I don't know. I think it's all DJs now, right? Who can afford a band when you just have one guy and his little laptop and garage band? I mean, really, do you need a live band to play school dances anymore? I don't think so. So I'm going to say it's not a thing anymore.
Of course, at my wedding reception in February, a live band playing nothing but swamp rock. I would love to hear from any of our listeners who have stories about, you know, eventually popular bands or artists who did play school dances for them. That would be a fascinating canvas, I think.
Absolutely. I remember and growing up in Winnipeg, our band was that came in and into the junior high gym was Harlequin, a very popular 80s rock band that made it big, but they were making it big by doing school dances, including the incredibly dangerous final fire stage fire bit, where I saw the roadie just plug in a box, a metal box, and he poured liquid in, and then they just knew by the time you plugged it in, the box would heat up to flash point, and then a big fireball would shoot out of it.
Highly dangerous, I think. You have a lot of, an uncommon amount of audience experience with pyrotechnics that either did or could have gotten very much out of hand.
Now that you say that, that's true, right? I never actually put all my pyrotechnic fire stories, stage fire stories together.
It either explains why you don't do that in your show, or it makes me wonder why you don't. I'm torn on that. So, we should have probably gone from this story about high school dances or school dances into the first movie I want to discuss. But sadly, yeah. I didn't plan the segues that well, because one more celebrity death, if you will bear with me. We don't usually talk about sports figures, and this person has no crossover into entertainment, except so far as Big League Sports really is an entertainment brand. But
True. But
my favorite baseball player of all time died. A true gentle giant in every sense of the word, the most San Francisco of all the San Francisco Giants, Willie McCovey. Stretch, as he was known, who cracked 521 home runs in his Hall of Fame career. He played 22 seasons in Major League Baseball, 19 of them for the Giants. He was a Rookie of the Year in the 1950s. He was an MVP at the end of the 1960s. He was the Comeback Player of the Year at the end of the 70s. So an astonishing endurance that this man had in the league. And just a pure light and just one of the most gentle men and such an ambassador for the game, and a civic participation award for inspiration is named in his honor, the Willie Mack Award. And I won't spend any more time talking about it, but well, yes, I will. I was able to be at Candlestick Park in San Francisco for his final game for the Giants for Willie McCovey Day, but I also recorded and somewhere still have on audio cassette the broadcast of his final ever game, which was at Dodger Stadium. And in his last at bat in baseball, he went out the way he came in 22 years earlier by driving in a run. Turns out to be the decisive run in winning the game against the Dodgers at Dodger Stadium. And in that rarity of all rarities that we might not see again until Vin Scully got this reception from San Francisco crowds when he was retiring, Willie McCovey, the hated giant, got a standing ovation by the Dodger Stadium crowd. And I still get choked up thinking about it, because the Giants and the Dodgers were red states and blue states before our political tribalism. All right.
Right.
Well, we're closing up the Chill Pack, Morgan. We're going to talk movies. Dean Haglund, $50 million opening weekend for Bohemian Rhapsody.
Bohemian Rhapsody, the biopic of the century. I don't know. Is it good? I haven't seen it.
Well, here's the thing. You know, having traveled the world about America, and you love America, your adopted homeland. Don't kid yourself. You love it.
Not kidding myself.
But you are a man who enjoys some of the finest wines and foods from around the world, and you know something about America. We love cheese. even when cheese is not really particularly tasty or nourishing, we just want cheese, and we want cheese on everything. And that brings me to Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, no! Ba-doom.
We have talked about Bohemian Rhapsody in the past because of all the drama surrounding Bryan Singer disappearing before the film was completed. He was replaced by Dexter Fletcher. And replaced, again, makes it sound like, okay, he got fired and they replaced him, right? But no, he went missing. He went missing when the tables started to turn in the wake of Me Too and in the wake of Kevin Spacey, and Bryan Singer's own behavior started finally being called into question. And hell, I don't even know where Bryan Singer is now or what he's doing. And honestly, I don't care. But
you don't care.
I do think it's interesting that he gets sole credit on Bohemian Rhapsody, and Dexter Fletcher gets an executive producer credit. Now, one would say, well, Bryan Singer was there for most of the shoot, right? But he wasn't in the editing room. And as we know, the director's job does not end on set. So it's interesting that they maybe wanted no part of the fight with the Directors Guild about it. It's also possible that Dexter Fletcher said, you know what? I'm just going to cover my ass. Everyone knows that I bailed this production out, and if it's successful, I'll be rewarded for that, and I'll get to direct something else. But if it's not successful, it's not my fault. And indeed, it wouldn't have been, right? What a thankless position this guy was put in, and what a heroic thing to drop in and take it over. Heroic not being the same level of heroism, for example, that our World War II Mr. Ettinger demonstrated. So, you know, it's... But anyway, we talked about it then, and... but I'm going to tell you that the problem with this movie has little to do with the replacement in directing. Though it does have to do with the fact that Bryan Singer is prone to giving into his cheesiest, fetishistic impulses, obviously, as we've seen in the past. But it's twofold. One, Rami Malek is a great actor. I have championed him, as you know, for years, not only Mr. Robot, but going back to Short Term 12, an independent film that I loved that launched Brie Larson into the big time. He is terrible in the so wrong. He is so miscast. Let me ask you this. What about Mr. Robot and that performance in Mr. Robot makes you think, yeah, larger than life, this guy?
Well, that's true. It's he's not larger than life, but I mean, in terms of soulful vulnerability and deep internal monologue, he's got that in spades.
You've hit kind of the nail on the head. There are more than one movie living inside this. There's more than one director, but it's not. But that's the point that I'm making, is that it's not because the director got replaced. The director got replaced. Often we could say, well, that explains why there's two movies going on here that are competing with each other. But we know the circumstances around which Bryan Singer left. And it did not have to do with the fact that, okay, there's a fight over what movie this is. But that fight exists in there. You know, I hearken back to casting that I think would have been brilliant, which was when Sacha Baron Cohen was supposed to play Freddie Mercury for the longest time, and then he dropped out over creative reasons. But how interesting would it have been to actually cast both those men then? And but you don't do it chronologically. It's not like when he's young, he's Rami Malek, and when he's older, he's Sacha Baron Cohen. No, what about in private, it's Rami Malek, and in public, it's Sacha Baron Cohen?
Wow. Wouldn't that be intense?
That's a more interesting movie from the conception. And might it not work? Might it be a disaster? Yes, of course. And would still be equivalent to the disaster that is this movie that we're seeing. And would affect the box office not at all, because people don't care. People love their queen. And by the way, that's the other problem with it. Can we all agree on one thing? Look, I love Queen. I'm a big Queen fan. I have all the records on vinyl. And I finally admitted something the other day, which is their music's not any good.
Well, no, he's an incredible singer. He's got a range, and it's a, you know, a vision unlike any other rock band. I'm combining opera, and you know, who else did that?
Yeah, look, I understand why people love Neil Diamond. I understand why people love Barry Manilow. Why people love Billy Joel. Why people love, among them myself, love Queen. But I am not going to pretend for a minute that their music is good. It is cheese going in and cheese coming out.
Well, and this is what I heard, that the remaining members of the band were on set almost every day, pitching ideas or suggestions, as it were, steering this production. So it sounds like if the music was cheesy, then and they were there, then chances are the movie is cheesy.
Well, so
and it sounds like you're confirming that.
Yeah, exactly. So again, I'm not telling people not to see it, and I'm not telling people not to listen. Look, I'm going to listen to a Queen record, I am sure, probably later today, because it's going to be planted in my mind, and those songs are earworms. So I'm going to put on the vinyl and I'm going to play it. What I'm saying is, if you are not a fan of cheese, if you are not a Queen fan, look, this is not a good movie. It's not a good movie. This is a guilty pleasure of a movie, the same way the band was a guilty pleasure.
I'm waiting for, you know, Styx biopic. I think that'll be the real.
Okay.
I don't know.
I just and by the way, they played your elementary school cotillion. I think it was. All right. Hey, I saw two more classic horror films that I am desperate to discuss with you.
Let's hear them.
Before we get to some new movies, the first of these, and never had seen these. My hand to God had never seen these. 1941's Kurt Seidmack directed The Wolfman.
The Wolfman with Lon Chaney Sr.
No, Junior. This is the
Junior.
41
was Junior.
With Lon Chaney Jr., also starring Claude Rains, who actually gets top billing, Ralph Bellamy, Warren William, I mean, Bela Lugosi. The cast on this thing is spectacular. And
yes.
And just as an aside, by the way, I think if there was any actor in history whose career I would have wanted, Claude Rains, that's the guy right there.
That's the guy.
How about different genres he got to be in? Someone whose ego apparently had no problem with being second fiddle, and yet you remember him in all these movies. I mean, yes, you remember Bogey so well, but who else do you remember in Casablanca? I mean, that's a whole love story built up about a friendship, and would it have meant anything if someone not as charismatic and fun, intrinsically fun, as Claude Rains played that part? Anyway, so many different kinds of movies, from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington all the way to Lawrence of Arabia decades later. This guy just turns up. I mean, there's a degree to which, like we always say about these great character actors, if he's in it, the odds are you might have a good movie.
Right.
Great acting. Great.
Yes.
Oh my God, the atmosphere, which gets used too much. It's literal atmosphere that you can see and touch on these sound stages and back lots. The look of this is so fun. Narratively, I don't think the thing holds together at all. I mean, it's like right when things get interesting, okay, let's resolve it. But are you a fan? Are you a fan of this?
I am a fan, but this one's particularly for the makeup special effects, of course. This we studied at length. This is Jack Pierce as well, I think. He did Frankenstein, and then he was called on to do this. And the laborious, I believe it was 5 to 6 hours, of yak hair glued individually to Lon Chaney's face, which is why they originally were going to shoot out in the moors, and they were scouting locations outdoors. And then when they realized that it's, the process, the transformation was going to take 5 to 6 hours, they had to move it indoors in order to control lighting and atmosphere and weather, because there's no way you could do that and have the same conditions when it's when he's in transformation in the full moon.
I also saw Nosferatu. I'd never seen Murnau's Nosferatu.
Oh,
which I was fascinated to realize is actually called Nosferatu, Ein Symphonie des Grauen, translated as Nosferatu, A Symphony of Horror, because it's that title that actually prepares you for what this movie is, it seems to me. Historically, so interesting that, of course, it's a ripoff of Dracula, but it's the first feature-length film about a vampire, so all the Dracula movies that would follow rip off the visual template of Nosferatu, just as Nosferatu was ripping off the text from Dracula.
Right, yeah. And, because it also let that pacing, like, the lengthened the tension, as it were, so, that the shorts never did.
So I love this because of the just the magnificent embodiment of German expressionism. I feel like you don't even have to say expressionistic horror film. I mean, it's just,
no,
it's expressionistic, and anything that the Germans back then were expressing was pretty damn horrific.
It was horrific for sure.
The psychology.
There was horror going on.
Oh my God. I mean, that's where this is so fascinating, is on the psychological level, visually. I mean, as he's casting this shadow over his potential victims, you think about the shadow growing over Germany. I mean, the spreading of the plague as a metaphor for these, what would become Nazism. I mean, it's an incredible, it still resonates. And it resonates now because maybe, again, of the political era we live in and the growth of, certain kinds of political expression and the death of liberal democracy around the world. So maybe it resonates in that way. I will say this, though, as a vampire film, I keep getting pulled out of it because of how sloppy they are with establishing any rules and then following them.
Oh,
like, wait a minute. He's not in this mirror, but he is in that mirror. Wait, now what are we doing with the mirrors? You know, I mean, it's daylight here, but it's daylight, but he hasn't bit someone, so then he's allowed to be. I mean, it's so, as a vampire piece goes, and I understand we watch these things in context, but if you're watching it to enjoy a vampire movie, it doesn't work anymore. As something that's about larger themes, something that is a symphony of horror. Oh my goodness. And the restoration, of course, uses the original scores from that symphony. So
I haven't seen the restored version. Where, how did you find this one?
Oh, I'm sure. Criterion and TCM, TCM broadcasts all the Criterion restorations of these films.
Damn it all. I didn't see that. Now I'm going to have to find it.
So what I think sounds fascinating, and now granted, I am a huge fan of both this director and this actor, but in 79, German director Fassbinder, right? Herzog. I'm sorry, Werner Herzog.
Werner Herzog.
And his best fiend, the actor Klaus Kinski, they remake Nosferatu. And it comes out, in 1979, gets good reviews. It's considered in its own right a classic now. And from reading about it, I actually think I would like that movie a lot more than the original.
Really? Yeah? I don't think I've seen Klaus Kinski in Nosferatu.
See, I kind of pictured that you, as a boy in Canada, that this would have been right up your alley as something you would have seen.
Well, I've seen the first one. Yeah, I saw the silent one.
We might need to watch that together then, because
that'd be creepy.
I'm hearing that visually, because Herzog never gets credit for having such a visual eye because his themes are so powerful. But he does often make visually very interesting films. And I heard that he really embraces the homage to that German expressionism. But the themes that he explores are about the crushing anguish and loneliness of the vampire.
And
isn't there so much terrain to explore in that?
Yeah, absolutely. I would think that's the thing. If you're the only one living forever, good craps. What the hell after, set aside the fact that you are maybe a high school student and you keep going to the same high school year after year for 113 years. I'm talking to you, Twilight. Anyway, yes, the crushing loneliness that would be the life of a vampire. That is a movie I would love to see.
Okay, well, that was a wonderful segue into a new movie that I saw, directed by Joel Edgerton. It's a big award hopeful. It's called Boy Erased, and it's a 2018 coming-of-age drama based on Garrett Conley's 2016 memoir of the same name, written for the screen and directed, as I mentioned, by Joel Edgerton, who also produces and who plays Mr. Sykes, a man who is running a gay conversion therapy for kids of Christian faith. And this is a film with its heart so in the right place. Russell Crowe and Nicole Kidman play the boy's parents. The great Lucas Hedges from Manchester by the Sea plays the boy. He's astonishingly good in everything he does. And honestly, if we ever dust off Illumination, that could be our guy right there.
Oh, fantastic.
But Russell Crowe as the dad, kind of walking through and waving, saying, "Hey, I'm Russell Crowe doing a little indie drama. Proud of me."
Walking through and raving.
But Nicole Kidman has some moments, and as she always does, and touches some interesting points about parenthood. But the interesting thing about this is heart in the right place, an important story, that because this still goes on, these ideas and the conversion therapy still goes on. And as Lily mentioned to me, and this is something that occurred to me while... the first act's great, and then in the second act, as I'm going, boy, this movie doesn't work. And yet, I'm going along for it because I'm willing to acknowledge to myself that sometimes it's enough to have movies that point out to us how we are capable of dealing with things that challenge us in a better way than our immediate instincts might lead us to respond to them. Movies have the capability of holding up a mirror that say, hey, here's a possibility of how we can respond to things. And that's no small thing. That's important. That also doesn't make it necessarily a good movie. And the interesting thing is, you know, I talked about Love, Simon on this show several weeks back. Here is a sitcom approach to a boy coming out in high school, being forced to come out. Both stories are about boys who are kind of forced to come out before they are ready to, and the ramifications of that. And the thing that Love, Simon gets in its sitcom way that is so much more powerful than anything in Boy Erased is that every single high school student ever is wounded and feels torn apart, regardless of their sexual identity. We all have reasons why at that age we feel torn apart and wounded. And that basic understanding of what it is to be a teenager escapes Joel Edgerton's handling of this material.
Oh, no. That's unfortunate. It's supposed to be, well, I don't know what it's supposed to be.
It is about the specifics of this. And because I think of that lack of understanding, there's some sequences that are wonderfully well directed, but there's other sequences where you notice the direction and you say, you know what, I am not experiencing this world the way that the main character experiences it, nor am I being placed in a perspective of, oh, I'm uncomfortable with how I'm being shown
manipulated.
This. No, or how shown I'm being this. Shown this. The perspective on this, right?
Right.
The big challenge of the lady killers, of a dark comedy. How do you put the audience in a perspective that's going to make them look at things a little differently, that's going to make the laughter stick in the back of their throat, that's going to make them maybe want to identify with something and then undercut and subvert that identification? There is no clear strategy for where he wants the audience to be, nor is there what he seems to want, which is really sharing intimacy with the character. When we say sharing intimacy with the character, we don't mean to have our faces rubbed in what he's experiencing. We mean to really experience the world the way the character experiences it.
Right.
And we don't we don't get that.
You don't get that at all. No. Well, that's tragic.
So, Boy Erased.
Seems like such an appointment.
A noble failure.
Yeah.
And speaking of noble failures, that had
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Had me as close to walking out of a movie as, I even looked up in it, during it, at the screening, how long it was to see whether I could make it through. And ultimately, I do. But
wow, you never walk out of movies.
It's a private war, which will probably get Rosamund Pike a Best Actress nomination. Though, you know how I feel about films that don't work and yet actors get hailed for them. You know, you can't say, oh, the performance was great if the movie didn't work, especially when you're the main character. No, it's not her fault. But the whole setup of this movie, which is about...
a journalist.
Journalist Marie Colvin, you know, who died in 2012 in Syria,
yes.
covering Syria, the only journalist from the West covering what was going on in Syria. It's equal parts that and a biopic going back more than 10 years to her addiction to covering wars. And think of all the really good movies about journalism and what makes them good. And one of those things is about really letting us understand the process of what it is to be a journalist. I'm thinking about Spotlight. I'm thinking about All the President's Men. Think about how they do that. Think about how they also never, when they are dealing with the subjects of the stories become the stars, no matter how big the movie star is playing the journalists. Right?
Right. Yeah.
When the stories are being told, it's the people telling the stories who are the stars. Robert Redford, Dustin Hoffman, you were taking a back seat in this. And you are having faith that you are doing your job because you're doing justice to the profession of journalism.
Right.
Which is a noble thing right now at a time when 60% of Americans don't trust journalists. It's important to see what they sacrifice. But this movie gets neither of those things right. This is a greatest hits collection of action sequences that Marie Colvin was placed into, punctuated by dramatic scenes in her personal life. It's all high drama and high action interspersed. And at no point is there ever really any story evolving out of her character, nor do we ever get to know or care about single person she covers.
Wait a second. I thought it was about a relationship with that photographer, the way the trailer's cut.
And Jamie Dornan tries, but and we care a little bit because he cares, but that only goes so far. When he shows up, I did sit up going, okay, we're one act into the movie, but the movie just got better. And for about 10 minutes, it became the kind of movie it could have been. And then they get to one of these high points of her career, and the direction is all over the board. I don't know who we're supposed to be following, what we're supposed to be feeling, what the impact is, what the meaning is, none of it. It's fascinating because it's a movie about a journalist and made by a feature filmmaker who's known for documentaries, and he doesn't understand the importance that all journalists do of get those why, what, where, when, how questions asked and then set about answering them.
Wow. Do you think there was a longer movie in this and it was just cut to action?
You know what? This was one of those experiences where I wish we did not lose the miniseries. I wish we still had the television miniseries, because this was probably the format for her. Every night, we're following her during a different war that she covered. And we also wouldn't have had to have a movie star, Rosamund Pike, play her. Honestly, on television, the person who kind of looks like Marie Colvin is Deborah Messing. So there's a TV star who would have loved to have been in this miniseries. There you go. And honestly, it's television that needs this movie. Because... Yeah.
I thought this is what Hulu and Prime and Netflix, this is was supposed to cure.
But
these
made
movies like Cloud Atlas and all that sort of thing that would have gone back to these formats that would have been binge worthy.
But
that
you would have had. They make series, limited series, not mini series. They are a different form. And so anyway, so boy, we're over time, and there's two other new movies that we got to talk about. But one of them is our movie, The Lady Killers. But I guess we're tabling that for another week.
Let's make that next week.
We'll focus on that next week. So I will end with another movie that was a long time coming, but this one even longer. It was shot in 1970 is when it started being filmed. It has been released finally in 2018. It's being pushed for maybe Best Picture. We'll see. But it is available now, streaming on Netflix. It's the final film from Orson Welles. It's The Other Side of the Wind.
Wow.
Directed by Orson Welles, co-edited by Orson Welles, co-written by him with Oya Kodar, who also co-stars. It stars John Huston, Bob Random, Peter Bogdanovich, who's so good in it, Susan Strasberg, Edmund O'Brien, Lily Palmer, so many wonderful character actors from the golden age of Hollywood who are still in their power back in the 70s when this was filmed. Get this. It is a movie where Orson Welles put together a rough assembly of it and was able to show it at a party. And the people who were there all said, this is a huge comeback. This is a huge comeback. This is a brilliant film. And then he had to turn it over so that it could be destroyed because one of the big financiers was the Shah. And when the Shah was deposed, the state of Iran got to take ownership of it. And hence a really messy battle over it. But so it's a filmmaker whose final film gets in a rough cut, gets to be shown at a party, and then never gets finished before his death. What's the movie about? It's about a filmmaker who gets to show his final rough assembly of his last movie at his birthday party and then dies before the movie can get finished.
Wow. The irony.
The first hour is so extraordinary and so extraordinarily difficult for most viewers. It isn't just modern. It is pointing the way to where films still might go. He was Robert Altman of Nashville before Robert Altman even existed in 1970.
Wow.
He is David Lynch before David Lynch existed in the movie within the movie, The Other Side of the Wind. He is combining every kind of film format imaginable, widescreen, Technicolor, black and white, 16 millimeter. It is a mockumentary before anybody had made mockumentaries. It is an incredible pastiche that is so challenging because of the energy, the intense energy. But you're aware for the first hour, oh my God, the amount of skill that a filmmaker had to have to pull this off. I don't know what filmmaker has the skill now to pull this off. And then an extraordinary thing happens. If you make it through those first 60 minutes, the movie really changes and it becomes this chamber piece that explores the three major storyline mysteries that you've been getting in bits and pieces for the first hour.
Wow.
And
you're kidding.
And then the final 20 minutes becomes really the exploration of the metaphor of what the movie is about. So it is an extraordinary piece. Is it fun? Not always.
That sounds
is
fun.
It incredibly rewarding and exhilarating? Ultimately, it was for me, yes. And he had every bit the power going out that he had coming into Citizen Kane. There is no doubt about that. He was imagining all the different ways cinema could go while at the same time spending his final movie just taking a blisteringly cynical and satirical view to the new Hollywood of the 70s, to the death of the studio system, to the culture of movie directors as celebrities that we were importing from Europe. He's making fun in no small way of the Godards of the world, as well as the Hollywood of the 1970s. It is a rich, rich brew my friend. It's The Other Side of the Wind. It's available now on Netflix. That's the end of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. We'll
fantastic.
Discuss our film, which is available on demand and this week on DVD and is coming perhaps to a theater near you. So check out that website, theladykillersmovie.com, theladykillersmovie.com. You can find every episode of this show at chillpackhollywood.com. Until next... Do you really want to say that? I mean...
No, let's hurry. Yeah. With everybody, we've gone long.
We've gone long, for crying out loud. So until next week, when we are going to be debuting, I believe, a brand new theme song.
Oh! Can't wait.
In honor of turning 600. Next week's our 600th show.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
My time has flied.
We don't look a day over 550. I mean...
you live forever on the internet.
All right.
Awesome, man.
Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.